conference, mark my words, we will make Brexit a success.
Hello, listener. You can't respond because you're not here right now, but hopefully you did talk to yourself there. So if you're listening on your commute, you made everybody think that you're a bit weird. I like to think that we have the kind of listeners that do, that will like respond to us in real time when we're talking into their ears.
That's true audience engagement.
Right? Yeah, correct. In case you're listening for the first time, my name is Jazza, and I'm on the internet. For reasons. And I'm joined as ever.
they won't let him anywhere else.
No, so. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I'm joined as always with by Jimmy Nichols. Hi.
Hi.
We talk about politics, social issues, and current events.
Very good.
Every week, more or less.
More or less.
Sometimes we'll be like, oh, slack off, whatever, yeah, I don't even care. It's been a big week, isn't it?
It has. We should probably, before we run down the topics, say that Oscar Pearson, who is the founder of the Chat Politics channel, is supposed to be joining us.
I didn't think that we were going to shade him publicly on the podcast.
I'm not going to shame him publicly, for various reasons. He cannot be here.
Right? Like, they didn't need to know that. Were people expecting him to be here?
Because we said last, Jazz's phone just got off.
Yeah, shut up.
More pressure. We said last week that he was going to be here. So.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have bothered.
We'll have him, okay.
he will be appearing at some point.
Yeah, we'll have you on later on. It's nice to have others, because let's be fair. You and I, only so much entertainment can be had.
Well, apparently 56 episodes worth of entertainment, yeah. Largely.
I'm glad that we're definitely entertainment and not news. Maybe I should redefine it in the iTunes store.
I think we're politics and news and politics or something.
Who knows? Who knows? What are we going to talk about this week? Because it's been a big one, isn't it?
It has been quite a busy week. To start off, we're going to be discussing the trials and tribulations of UKIP.
Yeah.
This week's trials and tribulations
of UKIP. I just meant it was a big week because I started my master's course at Oxford University.
Just slipped that in there.
Yeah, wanted to. I'm part of the liberal media elite now because I'm studying the internet at Oxford. Very fancy. So as well as UKIP, we're going to be talking about Theresa May and her repositioning. And the people that we're all meant to hate now are the metropolitan media elite, which I think that I'm now really part of that archetype. So everybody's meant to be jumping on the bandwagon and, you know, hating on me, blaming everything on me.
I mean, the irony is you've actually moved out of the metropolis to become part of the metropolitan liberal elite.
So, I know, right? Any vague metropolitan area, though, can be counted in under that guise, right?
I guess so. It's also, you know, one of the, you know, a very austere and conservative institution that you've joined in order to make that happen.
I've joined the Internet Institute, and the Internet Institute has had huge problems in the past of finding colleges for its students, because there's a load of colleges that still don't allow there to be internet access. And the Internet Institute was like, it's what they're studying, like, quite literally. So that's kind of like the overarching narrative that Oxford has. We move as fast and are as agile as the Jolly Green Giant from the Sweetcorn.
Only when they're awake and you're already using we.
Yeah. Yeah, I've drunk the Kool-Aid, it's terrible. I wanted to share something vaguely anecdotal as well from Oxford. When I was at the Freshers' Fair, because one must go, somebody had put the Conservative Society next to the Marxists, and it was beautiful.
That is good planning.
Yeah. Someone was having an affair. They had a very good time.
Yeah. But did they put the BNP Society next to the Momentum Society?
I don't think the BNP Party are allowed there. There was no UKIP, though. Even though there were meant to be a ton of UKIP people at the...
At the uni,
yeah.
There was actually a big to-do a couple of years ago when the Oxford Union, Student Union, invited Nick Griffin, who was then leader of the BNP, to speak. People were upset.
Oh, what's he doing now? There was a period when he started trying to do a like Cook With Me channel on YouTube. He'd made like a pork pie or something in a tutorial. That was an odd little thing that he did there.
I'm trying to remember if that story I've told is true. I think it's true.
Oh, I hope so. Well, who cares? Nobody checks.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, we're fine. But
please Google that before you tell it as your own story.
And then finally, after talking about the Conservatives making a grab for the centre ground, we'll see how.
We're going to briefly discuss Tony Blair's alleged threats. If you want to see it as a threat to return to British politics.
It's not going to happen. Anyway, we'll talk about that later.
We'll talk about that.
And then also, Trumpy McTrumperson, Mr. Trump, Donald Trump, our future overlord and benevolent leader. He there's a tape that surfaced from 2005 where he basically talks about
assaulting women.
Yeah, essentially sexually assaulting women. And he's had to actually apologise this time.
I think the news is that he's apologised.
Yeah.
The news isn't that he said something offensive.
That's not news. Yeah. And then also there was the vice presidential debate earlier this week. Did anyone watch? Who knows? But I did roll in after a night of freshers drinking. And it was live streaming on YouTube. Don't judge, I'm fresher now.
That's how you wind down from an evening out. You're like, oh, I'm so pissed, man. I'm going to need to put on some political
bites. Yeah, I'm going to watch Tim Kaine and Mike Pence go at it on American television. So, we no longer... this new format still knocks me for six because I want to kind of wrap up the introduction. But we're going to dive straight into UKIP. What the fuck has happened? So, Diane James... two or three weeks ago, got voted as the new leader of the United Kingdom Independence Party. There was worry about how much power she was going to have in terms of her ability to steer the party in general, how much respect she had amongst the higher-ups.
Well, I think she made a reference in her acceptance speech to the idea that if people got behind her, she'd be able to effect change, but if they... Well, implied in that was if they didn't, she wouldn't be able to.
Yeah. So. Well, apparently, 18 days into the job, she was confident enough that she wouldn't be able to govern the UK Independence Party properly.
There was this weird story on Guido Fawkes where they said when she signed the form accepting her accession to the leadership, she wrote some Latin initials which basically meant that she was signing it under duress. I don't know if that story had been confirmed like anywhere else, but apparently that voided her acceptance of the leadership and therefore meant that is the reason that the leadership reverted back to Nigel Farage when she quote-unquote resigned.
Well, bloody hell.
Allegedly. That's what it said on Order, so...
Well, we'll see. But she's out of the picture now, and there is going to be another leadership race. It is becoming slightly insane, right? The amount of apparent leaders that they go through. Because it actually turns out that Nigel Farage is still technically the leader of UKIP.
So this doesn't count as his, like, second or third return, whichever one we're on.
Are we not on fourth?
So he led the party, and then he left when that Lord guy took over. Then he took over again... And then he left after the general election failure, right?
Yeah, and then came back. It was basically a holiday.
Unresigning. And then he left after the Brexit referendum.
Yeah, and is now back again. Yeah. So that is four tenures as leader.
Technically, this one could be counted as the same one as the previous one. So
I mean, so could after the general election, right? He just went, had a bit of a sabbatical.
Yeah.
But he's
indicated that he's not going to run for leader right now, at least. I mean, he said he's never coming back.
He does deliberately seem to be leaving it open-ended, right? That he might come back later on.
Well, no, he said that he doesn't want to come back, but he's said that, I think, every single time that he's left. So, you know, doesn't mean anything.
But we have also, now that we have a new leadership election, there are... two contenders for the leadership who have declared right now. Granted, it's only been like a week. One of them being Stephen Wolfe.
Okay.
Who is? And then there's another like Asian British guy who the name escapes me.
Raheem. I can't remember his name. He used to be an aide to Nigel Farage, didn't he?
Yeah.
Kassam or something?
Something along those lines. Really, we probably massacred that name. I've just been trying to Google him, but I can't find him. Stephen Wolfe is very much the front runner. He tried to run in the previous election campaign that Diane James won, but managed to get his papers in 17 minutes after the deadline, and so was disqualified. Many people were pissed off about that because he's seen as an incredibly charismatic. He's a guy of mixed race and ancestry, and very working class. He's from the north, I believe, as well. Yeah,
and he's a barrister.
And yeah. So he has he declared his candidacy and then got into a punch up outside of the European Parliament, because he is a member of European Parliament. He's an MEP, and got into a fight apparently with Mike Hookham.
Well, Mike Hookham has said that he didn't punch.
Who's another MEP?
He said he didn't punch Wolf, but he described it as a bit of a scuffle.
Yeah, but there are accounts of Stephen Wolf taking off his jacket, suggesting that they take it outside. All very laddie, and actually what I would expect from a UKIP kerfuffle, to be completely honest.
Yeah, I mean, it was... It's a pretty great story, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
I mean, it's a...
No, but so, there's also... The main story isn't that two UKIP MEPs ended up having a fight outside the UKIP Parliament. It's that Stephen Wolfe was hospitalised after a couple of what has been quoted as epileptic-type fits. And so apparently he went numb on one side of his face. People think he may have had a stroke. There's no medical evidence that he had a blood clot or anything. And then the front page of the Mail the day afterwards had him in bed with his thumbs up, saying,
yeah.
Which is an awkward thing that people now have to do if they're hospitalised. They have to have a selfie with their thumbs up.
And there was another really, really awkward photo of Nigel Farage just standing over him with his hand. It looked like he had his hands down the guy's pants.
Oh, brilliant.
Or where the guy's pants would be if he wasn't in bed covered by
shit. You've been reading Guido Fawkes too much, haven't you?
That's what it looks like, mate. I mean, probably any reading of Guido Fawkes is too much reading of Guido Fawkes, but, you know, the point still stands is that Nigel Farage did take a photo with a man who'd just been hospitalised, and it looked like he was molesting him.
Brilliant. And now, Stephen Wolfe... It's being suggested that he be forced out of the race because of misconduct. That misconduct being the scuffle that he had outside of Parliament.
Yeah.
What a week. I mean, it's craziness, right? If I was Stephen Wolfe, I almost admire him for his persistence in trying to get into this position. And I feel like he should get it just because he's been banned for being 17 minutes late first, and now he's been hospitalised after declaring his leadership after the person who won stepped down. Like, it's... I just don't know what to make of it. Is there a story here, or is it just something where we look at it and we go, this is madness?
I mean, are there rules in UKIP's books saying that if you have a round of fisticuffs with another, you know, MP or MEP, you can't stand for leader? Is that a thing?
It's seen as misconduct,
right,
of not comporting yourself properly, which is quite nice that they have one of those. Lucy Fisher, who is a journalist at the Times, been tweeting about this quite extensively, and so I suggest that you follow her if you don't already. She tweeted out earlier yesterday about another UKIP MEP. There are lots of them. Aaron Banks saying that he would quit quit UKIP if the National Executive Committee banned Wolf from the leadership contest.
I thought Banks was just a donor. I didn't think he was an MEP.
Oh, is he? A man from UKIP.
I think he's a donor. I think he's like a multi-millionaire.
Thank you for fact-checking me.
Yeah.
We need that occasionally. But there's what seems to be a clear rift between people in UKIP who actually seem like they want to defect back to the Tories now that we're leaving the European Union, the Hamiltons and the Carswells of UKIP seem to be in that kind of a camp, versus the like more working class, hardcore members like Stephen Wolfe. What do you think? Do you think that there's any
there's an argument that split? The Tory brand in Northern England is actually too toxic for some voters. Like, if you're a, say you grew up in a mining community that all your family used to vote Labour, you sort of situate yourself in opposition to the Tories, you won't vote for the Tories, but you will vote for UKIP because UKIP are not the Tories. And to that extent, I think there's still a brand value in UKIP, if you like.
Is there not a brand value? I know that we're going to go into this properly later with Theresa May's repositioning of the Tories, but isn't that kind of brand of UKIP quite difficult to like foresee when Conservatives have really started a land grab for a lot of their positions on stuff like grammar schools, on leaving the EU, and on like even public funding? They seem to, the Tories seem to basically, policy wise, be UKIP right now, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It depends how attached certain voters are to the idea that they just will not vote Tory, if you know what I mean. And that, I think that's actually true even for like middle class voters as well. This point isn't relevant in terms of May's repositioning, but there's certain middle class voters that even if they look at Labour and say, well, I don't really support that person's policies, would find it quite difficult to stomach voting for the Tories just because of a historical aversion.
Yeah, but it isn't. Do you think that all of this shit that has gone down in the past week within UKIP, do you think that makes them seem less palatable, less electable? Do you think that that could be a problem?
If you think of the sort of guy who stereotypically, usually is a guy who stereotypically would vote UKIP, are they going to be deterred from voting for the sort of guys who settle arguments through fistfights?
And taking off their jackets and then being like, do you want to take this outside?
I suppose you could see this as metropolitan elite stereotyping, but I'm suggesting...
I mean, like I said, that's officially a demographic that I've been part of now, so happy to be that voice on this podcast.
I mean, UKIP is a very macho masculine political organisation anyway, so I don't think that's going to cause them a lot of problems. Like Trump, in the sense that they don't seem to suffer any brand damage from disasters like this in the way that a Labour or a Tory politician might.
So a lot of the media attention has been targeted towards Stephen Wolfe, obviously because of his hospitalisation. What do we know about Raheem Kassam?
So he's the editor of Breitbart London. Breitbart being an
outstanding news source.
It's a slightly paranoid Trumpian news source.
Speaking of Trump, Raheem's hashtag Team Raheem's slogan is "Make UKIP Great Again."
Yeah,
wonder where he got that.
If you follow him on Twitter, he's always coming out with these hugely paranoid explanations for why UKIP or the far right, although he probably doesn't see it that way, is getting fucked over by the media or the establishment or whatever. And he used to be an aide to Nigel Farage, as I think I said earlier. So in that sense, I suppose you have at the moment two Farageists who are fighting with one another.
Yeah. So Stephen Wolfe was the favourite in the previous leadership election before he was too late to enter.
The suggestion was that Farage was trying to position him to be his successor, so that he was Farage's favourite, and by dint of that, the favourite of some of the UKIP establishment.
But it ended up being taken over by a load of middle-class women, really, who just don't like Europe very much.
I didn't really follow like it in that amount of detail. Even for me, that was too much. Getting into the nitty gritty of the left and right wings of UKIP.
You voted to leave the European Union. Who are you going to be voting for in the UKIP leadership election?
I suppose for pure comedy value, it would have to be Raheem Kassam. If you're going to have a crazy, you need a full-blooded crazy. Stephen Rolfe probably has some reasonable opinions.
Yeah, he's probably reasonably electable, right?
Yeah.
But interestingly, despite the fact that UKIP has a tendency to rub ethnic minorities and people from immigrant backgrounds up the wrong way, the two frontrunners now, the two only people to declare so far, from ethnic minority backgrounds.
So where's Wolf's background?
I think he's half Afro-Caribbean.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, you're welcome for that nugget of information.
Actually, there's a lot of... migrant communities are actually quite religious, and obviously that carries with it certain socially conservative tendencies, which UKIP does represent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a trend you get within... certain migrants actually are quite keen on lowering migration because they want less competition in the labour market and that sort of thing.
Speaking of migration, migrants, Theresa May has managed to... Well, she's turning the Tories into...
a Conservative Party.
Yeah, well, no, she's turning them into UKIP, really. Like, she's positioned the Tories... They had... Conservative Party conference over the past week. She started by saying that when she was going to trigger Article 50, the two-year process of us actually leaving the EU, and that's going to be at the end of March 2017,
By the end of March,
yeah. Which may end up meaning that by the 1st of April 2019, we'll leave the EU properly, and that's going to be a lovely April Fool's joke. I'm hoping that it's all just meant to be an April Fool's joke. It's all pretend. It's not real.
That would be pretty good.
Yeah, that would be.
quite a conspiracy, though. A lot of people would need to be involved on that.
It would be a two-year-long April Fool's joke. And I hope that Theresa May has the humour to be able to make that happen. I don't think so.
She's not a politician known for her sense of humour.
No. But the Tory party conference was just like... It was as if David Cameron never happened. Wasn't it?
It's interesting we now have... there's actually a really interesting column from George Eaton of The New Statesman about how Theresa May's changed the Tory party from being a libertarian party to being a market interventionist, more socially conservative party. But we now have a situation where, like, before the general election in 2015, we had two basically neoliberal parties, headed up by Ed Miliband for Labour, David Cameron for the Tories. And now we have two... they're not the same, but we have two parties that agree that there should be market intervention, and they differ slightly on, the Tories are socially conservative. Jeremy Corbyn, I don't think you wouldn't say an outright socially liberal or like hardline libertarian liberal, but you know, it is an interesting change, I think.
I was listening to the Financial Times podcast on my way down here, and they were saying on there that this is basically big business don't really seem to have any allies anymore, which is a really interesting pivot away from like the Blairite and the David Cameron position that like really did favour big business, wanted there to be huge amounts of foreign investment. Were actually, despite what David Cameron used to say about immigration, actually quite keen on immigration in order to allow for there to be cheap labour and all those kinds of things. And all of that are things that business and big business tend to like, actually. And although some backed Brexit, even though it was definitely the minority of business... it was the minority of large business.
I think it depended on what... You know, as you just mentioned, like, scale. So if you're a large multinational, obviously you're not going to be in favour of Brexit because it's going to hinder your access to international markets. But for some smaller businesses, definitely backed Brexit.
Yeah.
But that was probably a protectionist move on their part. So it's not fair to say that business, like, one set of economic policies is favoured by all businesses because it depends on where you're sitting. But in a way, I sort of think... It might be a good thing that the tide has turned in British politics against big business.
But then it does very clearly leave a massive gulf in the centre ground that doesn't seem to be snapped up by anybody.
Well,
and Theresa May is able to do this. She's able to tame the right of her party, and she needs to because she has a very small majority. But you'd think that there would be... I mean, lots of people talk about the possibility of the Lib Dems having a resurgence because they're the only vaguely centre party right now, with Labour reverting back to Marxism, essentially.
You say centre, but... And I know this is something that political wonks say from time to time, but the idea of left and right, what does that actually map onto? What does that map onto? Because most people don't give a shit about politics, for starters, but generally it's all pretty mushy. And was there any substantial difference, I should say, between Nick Clegg's Lib Dems, mm-hmm. Ed Miliband's front bench in Labour, and David Cameron's Tories? Not massively. I mean, mm-hmm. I was reading today that Michael Gove, who a lot of people think of as a Tory crazy, was a big fan of Tony Blair,
mm-hmm.
and David Cameron once called himself the heir to Blair. Ed Miliband was in Tony Blair's government, and Nick Clegg and Tony Blair, politically speaking, are quite similar. So.
But people who occupy that centre ground in politics are still the vast majority in mainstream politics within Parliament, right? Within the Houses of Commons.
I'm not sure. They dominated frontbench politics for a long time, mm-hmm. And certainly the Commons was not in favour of Brexit. But more broadly than that, I don't really know. I think it's a lot more complicated. And it has a lot to do with how parties are structured and how votes go down in different constituencies. I don't know.
There was... you wanted to talk about the pontification of perhaps Tony Blair wants to come back into British politics in some way, shape or form.
He said in an interview in Esquire that he hadn't ruled out a return to British politics, but he couldn't say...
Is he this delusional? Is he so delusional that he doesn't think that him trying to return to British politics wouldn't end up being an absolute shitstorm?
Well, this is the man that still thinks that going to Iraq was the right decision.
I think
that speaks for itself.
Do you think that there would be a space for Tony?
No, not at all.
Even if he were to start a new party, perhaps?
What he needs to do is find, like, a puppet MP who he can blackmail sufficiently, and then that guy can have all the same policies that Tony Blair would have, but none of the baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And then he might have some chance.
It's essentially Chuka Amuna, right?
I didn't want to say, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so the person who was meant to win the Labour leadership in 2010 was David Miliband, the more attractive and more Blairite version of his brother who ended up beating him to the post. And he's no longer in government. He's running a refugee charity.
The International Refugee Crisis charity or something.
In
New York.
New York, yeah. And although it seems like those that occupy kind of like the Blairite area are still the majority in Labour, they're clearly not the ones pulling the levers. There's, especially with the boundary changes, a lot of speculation about their futures as members of the party and as constituency MPs because of the changing to those boundaries and the new selections for candidates that is inevitably going to happen. The centre ground and that liberal elite that Theresa May has turned her party against
Explicitly criticised the sneering metropolitan elites. And I'm paraphrasing slightly.
So although they are an electorally they're a relatively small group in terms of numbers in the United Kingdom, they're still people with an awful lot of power, and there doesn't seem to be anyone...
I'm not sure they do have much power anymore. I think... That sort of the thing is that that kind of political tendency used to control the Tory party and used to control the Labour party and also used to control the Lib Dems. I guess you could still say the SNP are not a million miles away from that right now, but those other parties I just mentioned, the Lib Dems have been destroyed. There's only 8 of them left. There aren't significant signs they're going to recover significantly anytime soon. And the Tories and Labour are now controlled by a Marxist tendency on one hand and a socially conservative tendency on the other hand. In a way, I think this actually somewhat proves... it proves the idea that... Because people will probably still vote for Labour and the Tories in significant numbers whenever we have a general election.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of proves that a lot of politics is has nothing to do with ideas, really. And it has everything to do with who happens to be in charge of the political machinery.
Yeah, but who represents people like us, like the liberal elite? Because even though we land on opposite sides of the big question of Britain and its future in terms of Brexit, generally we occupy that kind of... I think of it as quite a sensible centre ground that is pragmatic.
I'm disputing the idea that it's the centre ground, partly because I think the whole left-right idea is bollocks, but it just happened to be a consensus for... I mean, Thatcher was a lot more socially conservative, but in rough terms you can map the time from the start of Thatcher's premiership to the end of David Cameron's premiership.
Mm-hmm.
And... economically, it became very liberal. You could argue increasingly liberal. And socially, it definitely became increasingly liberal. And it was very much the state is drawing itself back. It's going to be more about markets, more about individuals. And that has been overturned within the last year. I wouldn't describe that as the centre ground. I just think it was a consensus for a period of time.
How much of this repositioning that Theresa May has done do you think is pragmatic in terms of controlling her party, and how much of it do you think is actually how she's going to be setting the agenda for the next 4 years until the... when we're expecting the next general election to be?
Well, I think the two scenarios you've kind of put forward in that question are one in the same. It's about party management at the end of the day. I think the more interesting question is actually how much do you think her policy platform represents her genuine views, and how much of it is just politics?
Yeah.
Or into Tory politics?
It's... well, most of it, isn't it?
I think most of it's her view. Do you think that's actually...
No. I think that most of it is her playing politics. I think, like, you saw it with the her position on Brexit. She kind of sheepishly said, "I want to remain," and then hid.
Yeah.
Like, and there's reports of, like, David Cameron's office at the time being incredibly frustrated with the fact that she wasn't campaigning stronger. And she's a classic Tory in that she will do anything for power and anything for stability. And there are political... There's a case for being like that, because when you're in power, then you can actually end up shaping things regardless as to what your tone is. But I, for one, especially on the immigration question, am super worried about the tone that the Tories are taking. I mean, we had the leaked letter that was from London School of Economics, where non-British academics are no longer allowed to provide consultation for the government, which is...
in relation to Brexit, but actually, that's certainly not the position of the Foreign Office. And it's very much disputed as to how, like, the extent to which that story is true, not in the sense anybody's lied, but has there been some sort of misunderstanding or miscommunication?
But then also you have the front pages of quite a lot of the papers at the end of the week were from Amber Rudd saying, who's the new Home Secretary.
Yeah.
She is now thinking of forcing companies to publish the number of foreign workers that they have. You also have school policies now where children have to have their country of origin and their ethnicity declared by their parents. It all, like, just in terms of a tone and a feeling around the immigration question and the ethnic and regional origin of people in the UK, It really worries me, because I think it means that... So when I was at Facebook, which is a hugely international company, the majority of conversations post-Brexit were everybody's exit strategies. And these are some of the smartest people in the world, and people that we want... I would want them contributing to the British economy. And the fact that that tone has changed, and these people don't want to raise their kids here anymore, that completely changes the society that we end up being a part of, and that really worries me. And I don't think that although being politically astute in the Conservative Party and having this tone on immigration is probably going to be good for a lot of their voters and controlling the right of the party, which they have to do when they have a small majority, I think it is inevitably going to end up with a more making people feel less welcome. And I think that's horrible. I like being nice to people.
Yeah, I share your broad worries about that sort of thing, but I do also think that the political class has finally been forced or chosen to bring itself slightly more in line with the way British people actually feel about migration. And you can say that's a negative thing, but there's also, in a democratic sense, it's fairer that way, isn't it? That if the actual policies that politicians are putting forward reflect the sort of country that people want to live in.
Yeah, even if it's a xenophobic country, that just makes me feel really depressed to be British right now.
It depends on your view, I guess, philosophically, about how much emphasis you want put on democracy and how much emphasis you want put on fundamental absolute rights.
Sure.
I guess. And that, you know, that's an unanswerable question in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But we've just seen a slight shift more towards democracy with the Brexit vote, which was... It wasn't an intended thing by Cameron to actually give people more democracy. Mm-hmm. He was just trying to shut his party up, but that's been the fallout from it.
How fair is something like Brexit, though, when only 37% of the population voted for it?
I haven't seen any evidence that if everyone had voted, that the result would have been significantly different.
Exactly.
I mean, I suppose it could have flipped over the other way.
And obviously that's democracy as well. In the UK, we get to choose whether or not we partake in it.
Well, the thing that Stephen Bush, also of the New Statesman, said after the 2015 general
election... You love
election,
this column, don't you? The New Statesman?
I'm not in love with the New Statesman. They just happen to have a couple of good columnists. Relevant to this conversation. But anyway, Stephen Bush looked at the data on non-voting potential voters, and he concluded, this is after the 2015 general election, he concluded that even if they had voted, it wouldn't have made a significant difference to the overall outcome. Obviously, you are talking, if the result is close, that it could go the other way but especially in the case of Brexit. But I'd kind of side with you, if you didn't vote... You're still allowed to have an opinion, you're still allowed to complain about the result, but ultimately that shits on you a little bit, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Anyway, from one depressing move of politics to another, Donald Trump. Do you like my segues? Aren't my segues good? They're not very good.
They've been quite solid this episode.
Oh, thanks, babe.
Write in and tell us how you feel about jazz and segues.
No, please do. So, Donald Trump, there's been a tape leaked from a conversation he was having with I believe it was a producer while they were filming an entertainment program. This was obviously before Donald Trump made his foray into mainstream politics, where he talks about a lady in a not particularly nice fashion.
So he said that because he was famous, he's free to... I'm sexually assault women, basically.
Yeah. Physically force himself on them, grope them, kiss them. He was laughing about the fact that he could probably get this lady to have sex with him, essentially, despite the fact that she was married and all of that kind of stuff. This is nothing new in terms of Donald Trump's attitudes towards women, but what's really interesting this time around is the fact that he's head-to-head against Hillary Clinton, and they have a debate coming up on Sunday of this week. But he's decided to apologise.
Yeah.
For once, which is... Why do you think that he's chosen to do that?
I think it's part of the classic pivot that American presidential candidates have to do, where they pander to, in the case of the Democrats, the more left-wing base, and in the case of the Republicans, the more right-wing base, and then once they get the nomination, they then have to pander more to the centre ground to win over swing voters.
But Trump has got... he's kind of half-assedly tried to do this by...
He's fundamentally unsuited to it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I was actually... I think I've said it before in this podcast, that he starts to lose as soon as he stops being hardcore Trump. And perhaps this is him stopping being hardcore Trump. And let's be fair, tomorrow at the debate, we're recording this on Saturday, tomorrow at the debate, Hillary Clinton is just going to bash him with this. And at the end of the day, he's insulted half of the population.
There's still
of
a lot
the
of
US.
Women who are willing to vote for Trump, though.
Yeah, but people are voting...
Will they still be willing to?
Something that was a real... not an eye-opener, but a nice reminder of the circumstances that we're in. Somebody from Trump's campaign was on the Today programme this morning, and Nick Robinson was basically saying, how do you justify voting for a man like this when you have a daughter and a wife and a mother? And he was basically like, well, because he's not Hillary Clinton.
Well, on
and that's also one of the... He just needs to not be Hillary Clinton.
On the Hillary Clinton records about this, there are substantial allegations of rape, sexual violence against Bill Clinton, that Hillary Clinton was certainly involved in suppressing or reacting to, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Her record on...
A lot of people would be very annoyed of a woman being held accountable for her husband's actions.
Like, I'm not holding her accountable for his actions. I am holding her accountable for the response to it, which was shoddy.
There were suggestions after the first debate that Donald Trump will be playing the Bill card the second time around.
I think that...
Do you think that would be a smart move? Or is that going to sour people even more to Trump? Or is he just pandering to his base and making sure that they end up being enthusiastic voters? Because I don't think there's a huge number of enthusiastic Hillary voters. They're very active on my Facebook feed, but frankly, they're two of the most hated presidential candidates of history.
I don't know what sort of effect it will have. I mean, my impression is that... I don't really have an accurate impression at all of what people feel about Bill Clinton's presidency, but Bill Clinton was lucky enough to be president at a time when the economy improved. There was sort of the booming 90s, if you like, so I'd guess probably people were quite positive about him. But, politics in the US appears to be a lot more virulently partisan than in the UK, so...
Well, it's what happens when you have a very clear two-party system.
Yeah.
It's been... I watch a lot of Samantha Bee, who's a female late-night comedian host. She's got a fantastic show. And she was doing kind of like a breakdown of, I believe it's in Maine. They have Governor LePage there, and he managed to win. He's basically a precursor to Trump, has said incredibly racist things, incredibly misogynistic things, and governs as such as well, and has managed to win elections because the liberal vote ends up getting split, and the last one that he won was by 8 percentage points. 8 percentage points, funnily enough, is the amount that the libertarians Gary Johnson is getting in the American election. Obviously, it's slightly different because of the Electoral College.
Right.
But do you... I still think that Trump has a huge chance of winning, even after all of these gaps.
I think he has a significant chance of winning. And despite what I said earlier, I don't think that... Well, I still don't think that small events necessarily make a huge difference in elections. I think the momentum and the general trends are far more influential than any particular gaffe or anything that's gone wrong.
I will say, though, so 538 are brilliant, polling data and statistics, news source and website. They have Hillary Clinton at an 81% chance of winning and Trump at an 18%
chance of winning. Well, that is a big shift from what it was a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
If you go back, I think it's probably a couple of months at this point, but they were more or less neck and neck. It was like 50-50. Even within the last couple of weeks, it's been quite close. It's been more like 60-40 in favour of Clinton, so that's a big shift.
Yeah.
But you look at it that way, there's still a 1 in 5 chance that Trump wins.
Yeah, I know. That's not many coins that you have to flip. It is chance of winning. But I think that his debate performance worried a lot of people. Like we said when directly afterwards in our podcast, that he started strong and then just descended into chaos, and then perhaps this gaffe is also kind of tying into that shift. What does he have to do tomorrow in order to come away with a win, essentially? Does he need to go on the attack, or does he need to rein it in and be less crazy? Because those are two very he can clearly do one or the other. He's not going to be able to do both.
I have no idea, to be honest.
If you were managing his campaign, what would you suggest?
If I was managing his campaign, I'd question myself very severely. I don't know. I thought the consensus view before the debates was that Trump was going to trash Clinton. So I thought if you just get the two of them on the same stage, it's going to look very bad for Clinton. I don't know. I suppose he... I don't know. I'm not even going to pretend that I have any sort of answer to this, because it's not like you have two candidates who are far closer to one another and there's like marginal chances for victory. They're pitching to very different sides of the electoral market.
Should I tell you if I were his campaign manager?
You probably should, yeah.
There's a phrase in the West Wing, and I can't remember the name of the president, but it's like, let him be him. And I think that you need to let Trump be Trump. He's gotten where he is because he says upon divisive things, and I think that he needs to go on the attack. I think that the last thing he needs to do right now is to play to debate strategy that he clearly isn't naturally very good at. He needs to be coherent, but if he ends up hitting Clinton on all of the stuff that people are sceptical about her for her emails, for her husband's presidency, one of the worrying things, even after Trump's debate performance, is how lukewarm a lot of the African-American community is towards Trump, towards Clinton, sorry. And Trump has basically been saying, hey guys, can't get much worse. Take a chance. Roll the dice. Give me a go.
That is essentially his pitch.
Yeah. Yeah.
The establishment has let you down for X number of years, and you need to go to someone else.
And incarcerations of African American people and people of colour in the US went through the roof under Bill Clinton's tenure, and I'm not sure, even though that they came out and ethnic minorities came out and voted for Hillary Clinton in spades in the primaries, and that's the reason that she beat Bernie. It seems like memories are coming back to haunt her.
Well, I think the best thing for Trump, or the best way he can exploit that situation, is if he manages to convince them sufficiently that they can't be bothered to vote for Clinton, as in, like, black people in America. If they can't be bothered to vote for Clinton, they're probably not going to vote for Trump, because, you know, turkeys don't vote for Christmas. But
sometimes they do.
Sometimes they do.
I mean, Brexit.
but, you know, if he could, like, capitalise, I suppose, on her general unpopularity and the general apathy towards her, then that would be okay. But I don't think he's going to convert a lot of people because he is, you know, so obnoxious.
Have you heard the reason why we should actually be backing a Donald Trump presidency?
No, but I feel you're
so the reason why is because it has been suggested by his campaign that Britain would, invoking what Obama said in the run-up to the Brexit vote here, said that the UK would be at the front of the queue for a new trade deal.
That's a weird pitch, isn't it?
Who's
that? We can't vote for him. Why would he even bother saying that as a thing?
Brexit in the US, I think they love, or at least I get the impression that in the US they love this idea of sticking it to the man. And that's why Trump is doing really, really well.
And actually, he doesn't enjoy sticking it to the man.
And Brexit has been celebrated in the US in a lot of spaces. We've had Nigel Farage go over and speak at Trump rallies. And they won't really understand like the nuances of Brexit, but they'll understand what it was, and it was two people's, like it was a population sticking two fingers up at the establishment. And so I think that support of the UK versus the EU, like, although it's not going to make anybody decisively say I'm going to vote Donald Trump, it's going to probably make him more palatable to those who perhaps have more of a libertarian view.
Potentially, yeah, but he's, I mean, if you're a serious libertarian, he's,
you've got somebody on the ticket, right?
Well, you've got someone on the ticket, but also Donald Trump is a protectionist.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he's, I mean, I guess he's social liberal in the sense that he, you know, he was pretty mute on the whole transgender bathroom debate from a couple of months back.
Yeah, he doesn't care big time.
There's a few issues he doesn't give a shit about, but there's other issues where, you know, the whole migration thing, Mexicans are rapists.
Yeah.
Build up that wall.
Quickly, before we wrap up, we had the vice presidential debate earlier this week with Tim Kaine, who is Hillary Clinton's running mate, and Mike Pence, who is Trump's running mate. I think this is quite interesting as opposed to previous years, because I don't think the VPs have nearly as much... are nearly as interesting as they have been in 2008 and 2012. Sarah Palin kind of, like, threw all of the rules out of the trolley when, because she was so interesting, and her debate was her debate with Joe Biden was one of the most viewed television events of the year. We seem to have reverted to a more traditional role for the vice president in terms of just kind of like sitting there and looking pretty. I mean, Mike Pence is a bit of a daddy. The gay community like him.
He's a bit of a dilf.
Yeah. Which is quite ironic because Mike Pence really hates gay people and took away fun. I can't remember what state he's the governor for, but he took away healthcare for HIV sufferers and put that money into conversion therapy.
Charming.
Yeah, I know. What a great guy. Did you catch any of the
debates? I haven't seen any of the VP debates, so you're going to have to enlighten me as to what went down.
Mike Pence won. However, there's been a lot of speculation that Mike Pence actually ended up outshining Trump and performing a lot better than Trump. It was a bit of a weird parallel universe where two normal politicians are running for the presidency.
Yeah.
And it was like a standard debate. Weirdly, Tim Kaine on the Democratic side ended up interrupting a lot and seeming a lot more flustered, which juxtaposed very severely with what Hillary Clinton was like in her debate performance. But those, it was classic two politicians avoiding questions and trying to score points. And in that sense, it was a bit dull. But at the same time, Mike Pence was, I think, the clear winner.
Surely you've got to be a bit of a political wonk to watch the vice president debate.
I don't think anybody cared. So I think this year, yes, I think in 2012 and 2008, they were as important and or viewed as important, whether or not they actually are or not, by the population, because it was like heavyweights. There were in 2012, it was Paul Ryan, who's now the Speaker of the House, against Joe Biden. And I think that because of the overhang from Sarah Palin, it was still seen as a really big thing. This time around, the VPs are just like a footnote.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting. I saw a friend of mine post on Facebook their polling card, because they're overseas American and they're going to be voting remotely, obviously. And you kind of realise, oh, wait, this is a dual ticket. It is Trump-Pence, despite the fact that I think that Donald Trump probably isn't very happy that Mike Pence outshone him on a debate stage.
It's actually quite relevant, the vice presidents, in the sense that both of the presidential candidates
are super old.
Yeah. So it's not trivial, the chance that either of them could fall ill enough that they'd have to abdicate.
Yeah.
If that's the right word.
Die.
Well, no, I mean, like, sufficiently ill they couldn't carry out their presidential duties anymore.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's important that, you know, The main show is the real circus around her.
Yeah, and that's going to be tomorrow. And I can't wait. You're going to stay up late?
Ah, good job, man.
I'm going to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's going to be a right laugh.
Yeah. I'm not doing that.
Thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you could leave us a review on iTunes, that would be great. Right?
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, good. Let me tell them where they can follow us on social media, and I'll try and find a nice example of one.
Of a review?
Yeah. Do it nice and slowly, because I'm just, like, unlocking my phone.
He's just hastily trying to search up a review. You can find us on Twitter at RightDishonor. People have actually been tweeting us off the last podcast. There was a guy called Marvin Gay, not the Marvin Gay, who was referring to, like, the different ways that the BBC broadcast the presidential debates compared to the American news channels. And the actual framing of the candidates, the BBC used a lot more wide angles, whereas the CNN and that sort of ilk did the two of them side by side, so you could only really focus on their facial features. And just talking about, like, some of the psychological implications of that, which is quite interesting. So if you go on our Twitter feed, you should be able to find that. It's a lot lengthier and more eloquent than what I just explained there. But you can also find us at rightdishonourable.com. where we post the podcast episodes and occasional articles when I can be bothered to write them.
Yeah, we've given up on me doing them, haven't we? Really?
Yeah.
So the review of the week is from August 2015. So if you'd like to leave us a review, that'd be very nice. Because there aren't many since then. Tartan Jeff, I don't think that we've talked about this comment yet. He's called it the media political equivalent of a football ramble.
That's pretty fair.
Yeah. The kind of tone that I like for us to aim for is people who two plebs in the pub chatting shit. Yeah.
Quite a lot of shit was chatted.
Yeah.
If we ever get like a proper fact checker to review the episodes, the litany of errors mistakes is going to be lengthy.
Let's not bother. Thank you very much, everybody. Leave us 5 stars on iTunes. Love you very much. See you next week.
Hopefully, where the guest will turn up this time.
Shade. That's very rude. Bye bye.